Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome a great guest co-host, one of our own residents in UNC Family Medicine, Dr. Roberto Rupchich.
Happy to be here.
You know, we're going to have an interesting show today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Natasha Chuk, resident of internal medicine at the UCLA Geffen School of Medicine, about a recent article she wrote about net neutrality, where internet service providers could stymie medical care. Can you imagine a world where you didn't have ready access to information that was really quick at your fingertips?
No way. I mean, I am on my phone, on my computer, every single day, and I use it to treat my patients.
You know, I don't want to go back to the time where I didn't have access to that, and we had to just pull out that big book, and you had to leave the room like six times to go back and forth to look up information or, you know, call the patient later in the day and evening versus being able to make the decisions right then and there. Does this issue threaten that value proposition?
We'll get to it.
We'll get to it. First, let's get to some research that matters. And our very first one is about how we could help the immune system fight cancer after surgery. And the results may not be exactly what our listeners are thinking. What are we talking about?
All right. So here's a study, very interesting enough, in which it sounds like an erectile dysfunction drug, yes, we're talking about Viagra, in combination with the flu shot, may help you pick up the remaining cells, cancer cells, that may be left over after a surgical removal of a tumor.
Yeah. And this, by the way, is not just kind of the random throwing things together to see what works. There's some things that really are at play here. This was actually in a journal called Oncoimmunology. And this was research that was actually done in a mouse model. But what they were looking at in these mice is to see what a common drug for erectile dysfunction like Viagra or Cialis and an inactivated influenza vaccination, could it help stop the spread of cancer after surgery? Because surgery kind of depresses the immune system and some of the cancer cells get released. So what do they actually find in terms of, Roberto, the metastases if they had the cancer cells and had surgery and then they got the drug or they got the flu vaccination?
So in this mice, they found that they had 129 cases of metastases with cancer cells in the mice with surgery. But now they found 24 cases with cancer cells if the mice had surgery and one of the erectile dysfunction drugs, and only 11 metastasis cases if the mice had surgery and one of the erectile dysfunction drugs plus the flu vaccine.
Yeah, and it appears that kind of immune cells are influenced by what's called natural killer cells and kind of killing these cancer cells that could be metastatic. But surgery causes a different type of immune cell to suppress the natural killer cells. And these erectile dysfunction drugs may block those cells as well as the influenza vaccination. So it appears that there could be really something to this to help block kind of what the surgery might do to augment that with something really simple and available. But this is not ready for humans yet, but they're going to do some clinical trials.
Yeah, there's a clinical trial that's going to be at the Ottawa Hospital by Dr. Auer, and it involves 24 patients, and they'll be giving them the tadalafil, one of the erectile dysfunction drugs, as well as a flu vaccine. And these are patients that will be undergoing some sort of abdominal cancer surgery, and then they'll look for their changes in their immune system and see if the results provide benefits for these patients.
Yeah. Any questions? Certainly, if you had cancer or loved one, talk with your oncologist. Stay tuned. Our next research that matters is about a drug that was just approved for prevention of migraines, the first drug designed to prevent migraines. We have some other drugs we've used for a decade or two, but this is one that's actually just approved, and it was called, I don't even know how to say it, Aimovig. You think I got it right? A-I-M-O-V-I-G. Probably has a brand name, too.
That sounds great. Aimovig.
And it was just approved, and people are going to be hearing all about it. What do we know about this?
Well, this is big. This is big because as you said, first FDA drug approved. You know, I didn't even know that because I get migraines just thinking about migraines. I don't think I go a day in clinic where I don't have at least one patient that's coming in for headaches. And migraines being one of the leading causes of these severe headaches that patients struggle with. Now, we've tried several medications, and we've tried of all sorts of classes, antihypertensives, we tried antidepressants, anticonvulsants, and we sort of, our approach has been that we just go down the list, trial by error. And not all of them are effective. And hopefully, on most patients, we find one that reduces their severity and their frequency of their migraines. But this one looks very promising from what I'm reading here.
Yeah, and it's for people who have frequent migraines, up to 15 migraines a month to try to prevent. There is a downside, which is that it's just approved, and we'll have to see the kind of the side effect profiles that gets into the population. I like to be what's called a late adopter. Don't be the first one to try the drug, but maybe not the last one either. And then also the list price, and I'm sure most listeners won't pay this, but it's close to $7,000 a year. And I'm sure like all the listeners out there going, wait a second, Dr. Goldstein, you're recommending something. No, we're not necessarily recommending it, but you're going to hear about it and you need to be informed before you can and talk with your doctors about what they recommend.
Correct.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is about new research on what's the best time to induce labor if you're like past 40 weeks. Should you just keep waiting or should you be induced? And I know that you are in a part of a program that really values maternity-centered care. This is an important question.
That's right. As residents here at the University of North Carolina Family Medicine Program, we spend about 18 weeks or so on a maternal child health where we take care of pregnant women and we deliver their babies. And I am very happy to hear that the conclusion of this article. The article found that induction at 41 weeks of gestation is safer than waiting, which is what we do for our patients here.
Thank goodness. And this was actually what's called a Cochrane Library Review, one of these kind of systematic reviews of 30 randomized trials involving more than 12,000 women with pregnancy in the United States and 13 other countries. So really, I think, says that for the great majority of women, that the induction really is the standard of care because it will reduce perinatal deaths, especially stillbirths.
That is correct.
So last research that matters, which we really don't have much time to get into, but it's actually research that was done at the University of North Carolina about trying to create more effective vaccinations against dengue virus and Zika virus, two viruses that really worldwide cause tremendous illness. And the bottom line here is they were looking at how the temperature of the body can affect whether or not the effectiveness of these vaccines. Really interesting because one doesn't necessarily think about that. One can think about the temperature of what you're delivering versus the temperature of the body where that thing's being delivered to.
No, I'm glad that somebody thought outside the box here because, I mean, the target was there. It should make sense. But somebody thought maybe the temperature, and sure enough. So hopefully this gets them further along.
This is in the journal Biological Chemistry, and there's not really good vaccinations for these viruses. So we're hoping that that actually is something we can look forward to having a conversation about as they improve. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Natasha Chuk, rising resident of internal medicine at UCLA's Defen School of Medicine, about a world where internet service providers could stymie medical care. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Roberto Rupchik. Today on Conversations, Roberto, we're talking with Dr. Natasha Chuk, rising chief resident of internal medicine at UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine, about a world where internet service providers could stymie medical care. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Chuk.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, you wrote the senior author of a interesting article in the Journal of the American Medical Association about net neutrality repeal in medical education. We're going to get to that in just a minute. But I think we'd like to know a little bit more about you and how you got interested in medicine and perhaps interested in technology and healthcare and medical education.
Well, I grew up in Orange County, which is a little south of L.A., and went to University of California, Berkeley for undergrad, and then finally made it back down here to UCLA for medical school and residency, and I'm now, like you said, a third-year medical resident, rising chief resident. I actually had no real close ties to medicine when I was a child or going to undergrad, but late in the game, I got exposed by being a scribe in an ER, and I loved the idea of, you know, using what I'd learned in school and being able to apply it to patients. I actually don't have a background at all in technology or policy. I did molecular biology in undergrad, and you couldn't pay me to write a paper. So it's interesting that I kind of got interested in this topic and started working on it. It was probably because I had this opportunity to go to this legislative day that our California Medical Association puts on every year. Our pediatrics program here goes every year as part of their advocacy training, and I thought it would be interesting, so they let me tag along. And it's basically this day where everyone descends on Sacramento, lots of doctors in white coats, and we go to committee hearings and meet with legislators. And I thought it was so cool that we were able to talk about a topic like opiates, for instance, and have a hand in getting a bill passed that would really affect our practice and patient care. And so I started thinking about these topics as I was watching the news more in the context of my training and the way I would deliver care. And so when I saw that the repeal of net neutrality had passed, I realized that I was kind of upset and uncomfortable because I thought it was going to affect me in my day-to-day. And so I sat down to figure out, well, let me flesh out how that might be and if this is something we should be talking about as a community.
Nice.
I guess before we dive into the article and maybe establish some definitions, can you imagine going back 20, 30 years ago to the times where we could not go online and just log into a database and figure out the latest evidence behind a certain treatment plan that we're going to provide for one of our patients?
I honestly cannot imagine a time where I would have to run down to the library, look something up, and run back to see a patient. I just wouldn't be efficient enough to actually, I think, take care of patients and move care forward. And I love the fact that we're able to both learn while we're running to see a patient by pulling out our phones. I'm often after clinic or as I'm going outside of clinic to staff with my attending, looking something up on UpToDate as I'm walking and developing my plan. And I'd hate for, you know, our training and learning to be kind of siloed away from patient care. I like the fact that, you know, we're able right now to do it sort of all at once, and it's kind of mixed up, and I think that's how training ought to be.
You know, I'm thinking about, certainly I was born in a generation before you all, and when I started medicine, there was the book called Harrison's, and it was the 1,200-page book where one went, and one had similar other books, but you spent a lot of time trying to find the information that you wanted, and it was incredibly inefficient. So lots of times during the day, we wouldn't have time, particularly at the point of care, to look up questions. And so you would be really faced with knowing what you knew, but not moving beyond that. And I wonder, perhaps you can speak, maybe Roberto, you can speak of, you alluded to how important it is to have information at your fingertips. Maybe an example, maybe each one of you, how does that information change what you're doing, thinking back to some recent cases that you may have each had?
Well, for me, I think it keeps me up to date, for lack of a better term. A lot of the literature that I was looking through about medical education and technology and the internet listed how trainees often use online tools to, quote, check. So if you don't have a lot of time, you may not check your decision making, but or if you don't have the tools, you may not go to the library and look it up. But if you have something easily available, like your phone or the computer, you check your plan against what's the current treatment. Recently on wards within the last year, we had a patient with C. diff, and I just went, let me check and make sure, because I know that these things are always changing, and it blew my mind that, you know, vancomycin all the way down. It was so interesting to me that I was able to, I thought about checking it, and then, you know, this big practice-changing decision that I hadn't, that was just in the days prior, had happened and I wasn't aware of, and I was able to deliver the most evidence-based care.
And that's for Clostridium difficile, for our listeners, a very potent, sometimes lethal infection that can happen to people pretty easily.
Yeah, I think that for me, it gives me a lot of confidence at times to be able to listen to my patient, figure out what it is that they're seeing me for, but I establish my differential diagnosis. What that means is pretty much what I think is happening. And at this level of my training, I'm usually pretty spot on, but I don't always recall the best treatment plan. And I am talking about within seconds, I can just log on to the database and figure out what the latest treatment plans are, and that just makes for a very efficient model in primary care. And I do not know what I would do without that, because I just cannot imagine seeing 20 patients in a day and having to look in a book. But I think for the purpose of training, even more importantly than when you're out there in your career, because when you're out there in your career, I believe that you're going to know a lot more, and that experience is going to play a factor into efficiency as well.
And we want to have you keep believing that of the next generation. We're one day in front of you frequently. Dr. Chung, tell us then the problem. When we talk about net neutrality, because I feel like all of a sudden we're like, I'm just going to throw the big words out there. And yet that's what your article starts with. What is net neutrality? And why did we start the conversation where we did, when we could just go right into talking these kind of terms that we want to throw at each other?
So net neutrality is this principle that internet service providers, so companies that, you know, like Verizon, Comcast, AT&T, that they should treat all data on the internet the same. So they can't discriminate or charge based on who's using it, what content that person's looking up, what website they're using to access that content, whether they're using an application or a phone or a computer. And this is actually a term that was coined in 2003 by a media law professor, Tim Wu, and he wrote a paper in which he kind of described that different communication media travels in sort of the same pattern, where it starts very open, and then over time it starts to centralize and consolidate. And he predicted accurately that in the next couple of decades we would have this tension between those who wanted to keep the internet open and those who wanted to consolidate and centralize it. And there are actually similar debates have occurred in the past. So the Telegraph is actually an example. There's the Telegraph Act of 1860 actually talks about how that we should be moving information from line to line, from person to end, impartially, and that there shouldn't be any intervention by the dispatches of the telegraph operators, which I thought was really interesting because this concept goes back a long time. But as it's applied to the internet, these days we call it net neutrality.
We're going to actually just need to take a short break, but we're going to come right back, and we're going to dive into all of the issues that you raise in your important article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. We're going to continue talking with Dr. Natasha Chuk, Rising Chief Resident of Internal Medicine at UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine, about a world where internet service providers could stymie medical care. Stay with us. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. Natasha Chuk, Rising Chief Resident of Internal Medicine at UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine. We're talking about a world where internet service providers could really stymie medical care. So far, we got into what net neutrality means, and I'm finding out here that internet service providers can sort of limit what is exposed in the internet and our ability as consumers to be able to consume that information. So I have a question here. Why is this important for us in healthcare?
So, you know, I think it's important for us in healthcare because we should know about the potential areas for bias in our decision making, and if it's possible, limit those areas. And that's, I think, one of the arguments that I made in the paper that I feel most strongly about. So if ISPs, so internet service providers, were allowed to do things like prioritize content or move content faster or slower, depending on whether it benefited them financially, we could see a world in which certain drugs were promoted ahead of others. Say if you're looking something up and want to see, haven't prescribed something very often and want to know more about it, maybe you wouldn't find that information. Or even there could be corporations that sell nutritional supplements, for instance, that could populate search queries with lots of information about their product that may overstate its effect and actually potentially mislead us into using those things when they're not maybe evidence-based care. It's known that basically being speed and accessibility of resources when you're using them in a medical education really affect what you choose. And so if content is prioritized, it could affect us greatly.
So this net neutrality was a principle that was really established that said you can't limit these things. You can't kind of selectively expose us to one thing or another, particularly because we wouldn't really even know we're facing this type of bias. And then the FCC that regulates the Internet of Things repealed in December of 2017 to repeal these regulations, so suggesting that it could change. So one question I have is, how does this net neutrality, this regulation of our exposure to information, differ than if we do, let's say, a search on Google, and our first 10 or 15 things we know may or may not be the full truth? We could be exposed to things kind of somewhat randomly. How does that work? Because that right now is part of net neutrality.
Yeah, so reordering search queries is something that has happened in the past with internet service providers. So it's definitely a potential that it could become more exaggerated than what you're seeing right now under current net neutrality protections. And also, the concept of paid prioritization or making things fast and slow, so having tools maybe behind being blocked or having difficulty accessing them could prevent your ability to use them, means that if, you know, you're really used to using some sort of free and open access tool and it's not available to you, that sort of falls out of your repertoire, and then you're left with just the things that the internet service provider has made available to you.
So you really, patients would really perhaps really object if they knew that their physicians were much more less likely to get unbiased information for which they're, as you and Roberto just mentioned, are frequently using every day, as well as myself, almost with every patient.
I think so, yeah, absolutely.
I have a question about this concept of a fast lane and a slow lane. And can you tell me a little bit, is that just the speed at which you're able to connect to these websites? What do we mean by the slow lanes that could be created?
Yeah, so it's the fact that if net neutrality protections are actually repealed, because currently they're in limbo. The FCC passed the rule. They voted on it back in December, and right now there are challenges to it in the Senate and in the House. But if these rules do go into effect, one of the ways in which ISPs in the past have used or tried to use their power to affect what gets delivered to consumers is to make fast and slow lanes, meaning, say, if Google pays them a certain amount extra than other search engines, that loading that Google page will be much faster than, say, loading something else. And if you really like to use a different search engine, well, you're now going to have struggle to use it because it's not going to be preferred and it's going to take so long to load. And we know that if things take a long time to load, we often abandon them.
That's right. So it really just means it is slow to come on your page.
Yeah.
I got it. Okay.
It's like when you had to have that modem, which happened before you were born, to get connected to the internet. You know, one of the questions, Dr. Chook, that I want to come back to is you mentioned how you got so excited by doing advocacy and going into the legislature. And it seems as if this whole issue is going to be going into the legislature to really have an impact again. And you bring up in your article that this abandonment of net neutrality actually may increase cost for nonprofits and those who rely on things like up-to-date or non-proprietary supported subscription journals. How do you anticipate talking about this with legislators and policymakers? Because you're going to need to, and we all probably need to do that.
I think what I learned when that first day that I went to Sacramento and I started talking with the state legislators was that they do really care about your expertise and your particular opinion. So, you know, as a citizen, it's important to it's important to reach out to your legislators, but your experience as a physician really, really matters. And so when you reach out to them, you can tell them what kinds of tools you use and how you're worried that that net neutrality repeal might affect the way that you deliver patient care.
What has been the overall response to your article?
It's been pretty positive. There's lots of physicians across specialties that have been tweeting about it. There was one tweet I really liked. Someone linked to the article and said, "Well, that's terrifying." And while I wasn't really going for that exactly, I appreciated that it resonated with him.
And for the kind of lay listeners who across the country who may be tuning in, what's your kind of final words of advice to them about what you hope to see, you know, in the next coming months and maybe year or two?
I want to convey that I think it's important that we all get involved with policies that are going to affect us. So whether or not you think net neutrality is going to affect you or the repeal of the rules, regardless, it's important to know what kinds of things are coming down the pipeline in terms of policy changes, and if they affect you, to reach out to your representatives. So this is a super current topic. The Senate just voted on it, and at some point, hopefully in the next 60 legislative days, the House will vote on it, and you can reach out to them and share your opinion.
Well, we certainly appreciate you sharing your opinion in a big-time way. I think the Journal of the American Medical Association was a pretty good place to start, and we're going to post a link to the article on our website, and thank you for joining us today on Your Health.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but we've been talking with Dr. Natasha Chook at the UCLA Deaf and School of Medicine about a world where internet service providers could stymie medical care. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Roberto Rupchit. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Well, welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
My doctor recently recommended that I do a sleep study. It took forever for my insurance to approve it with lots of back and forth. And then they finally did, but I found out that it would be upwards of $3,000 out of pocket. I wasn't expecting that cost, and I'm wondering what my next move should be.
Well, you probably want to not move to another state. You don't want that type of move here because this is already expensive. And, you know, Roberto, I'm sure you see patients all the time that have these high deductible plans. And so you get one study, like a sleep study, that's really expensive, and it's going to be out of pocket for a lot of patients. And that is a problem because that's an expensive study. But on the other hand,
that is tough because if your doctor recommended the study, I suspect that there's evidence that you may need certain treatments. I suspect that they think that you may have sleep apnea, and without the study to confirm it, the treatment for it, which is a CPAP machine, won't be covered. So you're in a tough spot. I don't want.
Yeah, I think one of the things you could do is shop around a little bit. There may be some other places that can do the sleep study that may be cheaper. There may be, if you're at a university setting, there may be some other fees involved that could drive up the cost. You could see if there's an area in private practice. Conversely, if you're going to a private practice or in a private setting where this could be higher, maybe see at the university setting could be cheaper. So I think sometimes we don't have the comparison price shopping that we would do if we were looking for a car, where we'd go several different dealers and look online. It's not so easy to find, but it may be worthwhile.
I agree. Great point.
And then I guess the last thing would be to see if you could work out a payment plan, or see if they're willing actually to negotiate, just like sometimes going to the car. Maybe some people will be willing to negotiate and do it for a little less. Can't hurt to ask. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 45-year-old woman, and recently I've noticed that I have an increase in acid reflux. It doesn't seem to be associated with any certain food. I've been just buying Nexium over the counter, but should I do something more?
Well, clearly what you're doing thus far isn't fully working. So, Roberto, how do you think about things when someone comes to you and they're complaining or they have symptoms of reflux, and they say, but, you know, I've been taking antacids. What sort of things go through your mind?
Well, my approach is one in which I want to see what the patient has done prior to starting medical therapy. I want to make sure they've elevated their bed, and want to make sure they're not eating anything 2 hours prior to going to sleep, because when your stomach is full and you go horizontal, that puts a lot of pressure in that sphincter between your esophagus and your stomach, and that can exacerbate reflux pretty harshly. So I'll do a little bit of history taking, and if it does sound like a straightforward reflux, I will do a trial of a medication. Now, we take very seriously now putting patients on these medications, because there could be some potential side effects down the road.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that I would sometimes think about is what medications other than the antacids are you on? So I've been surprised how often someone will say, well, yeah, I'm just taking a baby aspirin.
Right.
It's like, oops, you know, that's like leaving your car in neutral. It's going to roll, and that could be really upsetting of the stomach. And so you're going to have to, you know, stop something that's irritating. Someone might be drinking 5 cups a day of coffee, or having Mountain Dew, or something with high amounts of caffeine, which lowers that sphincter pressure. So we got to really, as you just said, take a better history, understand better here, because not everything that seems like it's reflux is reflux. So there could be other things. I've been fooled sometimes by the gallbladder. You know, you think it's just an irritated stomach, but it's really a gallbladder kind of lurking out there.
Yeah. So my big tip is, like you said, Adam, no sodas, no caffeine. Just try that first, because that those sugary drinks, I've seen it time and time again. When the patients stop that, their reflux also improves.
You know, one thing we don't ask people enough about, when we also sometimes get fooled about, alcohol.
Oh, yeah.
And smoking. Two things that really cause so much reflux, cause so much problems with heartburn, ulcers here. So it's not so quite as simple here. Thank you for a great question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've had a persistent headache for 10 days. I'm in my 30s and I don't have any other symptoms, but it's so bad that Tylenol and ibuprofen are not helping the pain. Do you think I need an MRI?
What do you think? This is a tough question. Sometimes we get questions like this, Roberto. People coming in and all of a sudden something seems different, either a new headache or a headache that's worse than one they've had before.
Yeah, I think we take this seriously. I think a new headache is certainly a change. But what's going on here? I mean, let's just throw the word out there. We're all scared of cancer. We all want to make sure that we don't have a tumor in our brain that's causing this headache. But let's not jump right away to that. Let's see what we've done, when we have taken these medications, what have we tried so far? And also, are you stressed? How much is stress playing a role in your life? Any big life change recently happened that you're worried about? Because that could be an explanation right there. And what are we doing to deal with that?
Yeah, I was with a patient not too long ago, and they said they weren't really having much stress. And then I went to just kind of examining the back of their neck and their shoulders, and it was like a big knot, you know. And I was like, whoa. And they're like, ow. And I was like, well, you know, what's going on here? And they said, well, you know, I've been like working at my computer 12 hours a day and having these deadlines for work, and I'm not getting much sleep, and I'm not eating very well. And by the way, I haven't exercised.
Exactly. Or I used to drink 4 cups of coffee a day, and I decided to quit all of a sudden.
Yeah. So there are a lot of reasons out there. But at the same token, if all of that's negative, it's the worst headache you've ever had, and you haven't had stuff like that before, we will take it seriously. And at times, we will do an MRI or an assessment. But that may not be the first thing we do if we can come up with another reason.
Agree.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
I went to see my doctor recently to check in on a new diabetes diagnosis. I had lost 10 pounds, but to be honest, I wasn't paying much attention to what I was eating, just eating less. I was kind of surprised to see that my blood sugar was actually worse. I'll admit that I haven't been exercising, but I thought that simply losing weight would help some. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, there are some things that are good here and some things that aren't good here. And, you know, the losing of some weight, if you were overweight, was probably a good idea and ultimately really should help out with the blood sugars.
That's right. So the fact that, you know, type 2 diabetes, when we lose weight, usually that results in an improvement in your sugar control. So what's happening here? I think things that come to mind is one of two things. The first thing is this diabetes just quickly progressing to the point where the patient may need insulin? Is there not enough insulin being produced in the body? And or let's pay a little bit closer attention to what it is that we're eating. Because we may be losing weight because we're eating less, but we may be eating a lot of foods that are very high in carbohydrates.
Yeah, you could be having fruit juice and things that you might think are just fine, but they actually could be causing disruptions in your blood sugar. And I think we talked in a prior show, Roberto, about some research that fasting, like not eating so much, actually can have disruptive things on sometimes the free radical formation and injuries to the pancreas. So we actually could be doing some harm, particularly if we were actually fasting as part of this not eating. So I think you got to work on eating the right foods. I would definitely see a nutritionist.
That's right. I think that is probably the best advice we could give.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls today. And we want to thank all our listeners for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to our listeners. Any question or story that our listener wants to share with us, send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, Dr. Natasha Chook, our great guest today, and we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Roberto Rupsich.
And look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.